Okay, when I saw Dr. Boggs earlier, it reminded me of when I had him in class, and the class was a sheep judging class, and I don't know whether it was his teaching techniques or whether it was my expertise in sheep judging, but you can see that I didn't seek out a career in sheep judging and decided to go into transgenics instead. If I look back over the last 20 years of transgenics, it may be that I should have chosen a career in sheep judging instead of transgenics, the way things have gone. But I am happy to be here giving this presentation. I have spent a lot of years working in the area of transgenics, but giving a presentation like this gives me an opportunity to kind of go back and think about how it all got started and look at the history of how things have changed and really what is the progress that we've made. When I first started thinking about this, I was reminded of a paper published in Nature, and it was a paper back about 1983, I believe, and on the cover, they had a picture of two mice. They had a transgenic mouse and a control mouse, and the transgenic mouse was at least twice as big as the control mouse. So the transgenic mouse actually had a gene for human growth hormone. So it would create a tremendous excitement, and we all thought that there would be elephant-sized cows running around in the fields in the next 5 or 10 years. Well, I suspect that many of you, most of you, have not seen any elephant-sized cows running around. In fact, this day and age, it may be that you wouldn't want elephant-sized cows. But the fact is that there was a lot of promise in transgenics back 20 years ago. And when we look at really what has happened and look at the applications, we probably would have to say that we'd be significantly disappointed. On the other hand, when I listened to Dr. Faber's presentation and looking at his graph showing progress over time, when I look at this technically, there's been a tremendous amount of progress. And I think what happens sometimes is that a new technology comes out, and we assume that immediately there's going to be an application that follows. And that's not the case. I think, as Dr. Faber said, a lot of times you need a collection of technologies to put together to actually be able to make a system work and be able to apply it to something like the agricultural industry. So that's what I'll talk about for the first part of my presentation. Let me get my... Okay. This is an overview. So for the first part of the presentation, I'll talk about transgenic technologies and where we've come in technological development for making transgenic animals. This side, I think, has been extraordinarily successful, and there will be some things that you probably have not heard about that I'll be talking about here. Then I want to turn to the applications and talk about direct applications in agriculture, what's been done, and what are some of the impediments to actually moving transgenic animals into commercial agriculture production. And then talk a little bit about human medicine, in particular some of the work that we're doing at Hemotech. So I'm going to give you a little different version, but basically a review of some of the information that Dr. Faber gave you on what the normal reproductive process is, and particularly some of the terms that we'll use so you're familiar with what they are. Basically, we have, we have a sperm, an oocyte. These are the metaphase chromosomes from the oocyte. So it's the sperm genetics along with the oocyte genetics. The sperm genetics gives rise to one nucleus, or one pronucleus, in the first fertilized egg, in the first one cell stage. The female gives rise to the female pronucleus. So this is what we call a pronuclear embryo. It has a sperm-derived nucleus and a female-derived nucleus, each with a set of chromosomes to complement each other and make a fully diploid embryo. So the embryo, pronuclear embryo, then, after about 7 days, gives rise to a blastocyst, which is the stage that you transfer into a recipient. This is an embryo that has a couple hundred cells. It's a hollow ball with a fluid-filled cavity, and it has a hunk of cells off to the side, which eventually give rise to the calf. These other cells give rise to the placenta. So that's your basic embryology. Things to remember here are the pronuclei and the fact that we have a nucleus contributed by the sperm and one contributed by the egg. Now, the first technology used for making transgenic animals, which again goes back to the early 80s and is still used today, is pronuclear microinjection. Basically, this is the direct microinjection of a few thousand copies of a gene into the pronucleus of a recently fertilized embryo. So it's a fairly crude system of sticking a needle into the pronucleus and injecting fluid with a few thousand copies of DNA. Now, this technique has been used extensively in mice. It's been very successful in making transgenic animals, but the fact is, for large animals, there are a lot of limitations that really keep it from being very practical. For example, gene integration into the host DNA is random. You have all of these copies floating around in here, and where they integrate into the host DNA is just completely random, could be any place. In fact, it actually could be inserted into an important gene and, in fact, cause a harmful mutation, where there could be 100 copies inserted in one place. So it's a system that's not very controllable. And this is a problem for agriculture. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later. The other problem is that the efficiency of the system is very low. So you would need to inject about 1,000 embryos to produce one transgenic calf with this system. So you can imagine going to Transova and telling them that you want to recover pronuclear embryos from the oviduct of cows. You need to have about 1,000 of those to microinject and transfer into recipients. Now, you can imagine that Dr. Faber would have a big smile on his face for the bill that he was going to charge you for that. But technically, that becomes very, very difficult, although they've done it. And it becomes expensive. So once you do this microinjection, only a few calves will carry the gene, and still fewer will pass the gene on to offspring. So what you end up with is very, very little after a lot of effort, and the question is it actually any good? So there are many limitations. Consequently, this procedure has not been used extensively to make transgenic cows, as you might expect. Now, Dr. Faber talked about added technologies that make a technology applicable. And he mentioned and went through the in vitro embryo production system. And this is just a reminder of that system again, where we take ovaries from the slaughterhouse, aspirate the ovaries, the eggs from the ovary using a needle and hooked to a tubing that has suctions attached to it. We have a group of people that come in. In fact, we have one lady that comes in part-time. She has kids at home. She comes in over lunch hour, and they sit around with their needles poking ovaries and having their conversation. And they collect 600 oocytes per day doing this. Then you put those in culture, and you go through an in vitro maturation period, which is about 24 hours. So then, after the eggs are matured, they're ready to be fertilized, and we can do the fertilization in vitro. And that actually works quite well once you get the system set up and figure out the conditions. We then also can take this fertilized embryo here, and we can culture it in vitro to the blastocyst stage for 7 days. So we can transfer directly into the uterus as opposed to going back into the oviduct. So these three technologies, in vitro maturation, in vitro fertilization, and in vitro development, collectively called in vitro embryo production, have really helped out in much of the work that we do with these different technologies. So they're incredibly important points, which we don't talk a lot about, but were critical to being able to do some of the things that we do currently. So with these technologies, large numbers of embryos can be produced in vitro at very low cost. This is a study that I find interesting. It is a study published by Will Eystone a few years ago, and they were trying to make transgenic calves, and went through and did this absolutely massive project. And it shows what you can do with these in vitro systems. But they actually made 36,530 pronuclear embryos. They then had 1,472 that actually developed to a point that they could transfer into recipients. They produced 226 calves. 18 of the calves, or only 8%, were actually transgenic. So you can see the incredible losses that are occurring. And then of those that are transgenic, the transmission to offspring in some cases was almost nothing. In other cases, it was about the expected 50%. So you can see the amount of effort that it's been required to make transgenic cows. And you can understand why we don't have elephant-sized cows running around in every pasture. Now, in the past, in the past 6 years, a new technology has come about, and this is the embryo cloning technology. Now, most people look at embryo cloning and say, well, yes, you can use it to make genetically identical animals. Well, we don't think of cloning necessarily from the standpoint of making identicals. We look at it as an approach to do genetic manipulations. And let me explain this a bit. Now, in this situation, of course, we produce our eggs in vitro, and we have, normally we would have a sperm here. Instead of the sperm, what we can do is we can take skin cells from the cow. So, in fact, if we want to clone a cow, you take a tiny little biopsy from the back of the ear. I mean, it's not even cosmetically significant. Very tiny little sample. And we can grow out millions of cells from this. Now, one of the things that in allowing us to use skin cells as our genetic source, and being able to grow millions of these cells in culture, we can do genetic modifications that are very, very inefficient. So we can select out that one cell out of 10 million that worked. And we can make cows, we can make an unlimited number of cows from that single cell that worked out of 10 million in a population. And that is a very, very powerful system. So with the skin cells, we can do our genetic modification, and I won't go through the techniques for doing this. And then the next step is that we take our egg, and remember, the egg has its own DNA. However, the skin cells have both the maternal copy and the paternal set of chromosomes. So they have they're diploid, they have two sets of chromosomes. If we had the egg chromosomes in here, this thing wouldn't work. It wouldn't develop. So we got to get rid of the egg chromosomes. And then we transfer the cell from the skin cells into the egg. And effectively, that's how you clone. Now, you see here that we have an embryo with two nuclei, one from the sperm, one from the egg. In the case of a clone, what we actually have is just a single nucleus, which has both sets of chromosomes, both male and female. And then these will go on and produce embryos and can be handled essentially like normal embryos at this point. So that's the process of embryo cloning. Now, let me do a comparison of making transgenics via cloning versus transgenics made by pronuclear microinjection. With cloning, now, without doing any kinds of added manipulations, we don't solve the problem of gene integration being random. So we have the same problems as with pronuclear microinjection. But I'll tell you how we can get around that. On the other hand, for the efficiency, instead of 1,000 manipulated embryos, we actually only need, and let me switch this. Whoops, I forgot that one. If you put a lot of animation, you're bound to forget one here. But we make a significant improvement in efficiency. So in this particular case, we only need 100 embryos to produce one transgenic calf. Now, to put that in perspective, our laboratory does about 500 of these manipulations per day. So we could actually do enough clones in a day, potentially, to make 5 transgenic calves one day. Very easy. All the calves carry the gene. So in contrast to pronuclear microinjection, where only 8% in the one study carry it, well, all of the calves will carry the gene in this case, and most will pass the gene to the offspring. So we've made some substantial improvements in the efficiency of making transgenics. And in fact, I would say at this moment in time that just making a transgenic by doing random integration is a piece of cake. We can make all sorts of transgenics. It's cheap, it's fast, works. It's not really a big problem. However, this problem over here is something that needs to be addressed for agricultural applications. Now, with transgenics by cloning, we can go on and we can do some much more sophisticated things than just putting a gene in randomly. And let me demonstrate or talk about a couple of those, and I'll talk about more of these later. But the two kinds of added manipulations that we can do is, first of all, we can now do gene targeting. So instead of putting a gene in the host in a random location, we can actually target the gene to a specific site along those 3 to 3 billion base pairs of DNA. We can put it in exactly where we want it. Now, that becomes a very important technology and allows us to do some important things. First of all, it allows us to knock out the function or replace genes. Let me give you an example of this. Say you have one of the Angus that Dave showed previously, top genetics. However, this Angus has, say, some mutated gene that carries along some recessive trait. You want to get rid of it. And in fact, you find that G is present in all of our elite Angus animals. Well, what do you do? Well, you could set up and you could do crossbreeding. You could bring in other genetics, crossbreed, and then try to breed out and select for those that do not have that mutated trait. Or the other alternative is that we could actually take that trait from another animal, and maybe the ideal trait comes from a Brahman breed. We could take that trait or that gene from the Brahman. We could actually go in and replace the Angus gene with that specific gene. So, you know, maybe it's something else. Maybe the Brahman has a gene for disease resistance that we want to put into the Angus line. Well, we could actually do that. We can take that specific set of sequence of DNA. Now we can take it out and we can put it into our elite Angus without having to dilute their genetics. The other thing is that we can insert genes into sites that do not cause harmful mutations. You never really know when you put a gene in randomly what might happen if we actually made a homozygous animal. In a heterozygous state, the gene oftentimes doesn't show up as creating any problem. You breed to homozygosity and you find out that, lo and behold, it integrated into something where you can get by with one copy, but you can't get by with no copies. So you have to breed the animals to homozygosity to ever find out whether you have a harmful mutation with a random insert. With a targeted insert, we can direct that gene to a place where we know it's not going to cause harm. It's not going to cause a harmful mutation. And also we can get predictable expression. With random integration, you can insert the DNA into a site that is essentially turned off in the genome and doesn't express, and in fact, it may turn off your gene. Or you can put it into a site that's highly expressed and get overexpression of that gene. Well, we can control that if we can say where we want to put the gene and put it there. Now, the other thing that is now possible is microchromosome transfer. This is the insertion of a very long sequence of DNA. Let me give you a comparison. A regular transgene might be 20,000 base pairs. A microchromosome can be 10 million base pairs. So it allows us to put in huge, huge chunks of DNA. And in fact, these chunks of DNA can carry large complex genes or could carry essentially hundreds of genes. And in fact, we've done that. We've transferred a microchromosome that probably carries not only large complex genes, but about 50 genes with it. So now these two technologies are something that have just recently been possible and may impact what we can do in the future towards making transgenics applicable to animal agriculture. So to conclude on this, I would say that first of all, pronuclear injection, that's passed. It's okay for mice, but if you're trying to make transgenic cows, forget it. It's just not worth it. On the other hand, transgenic cell cloning is miles ahead of it and makes transgenic modifications very, very simple. And I think if I had to conclude on the technology side, I would say that transgenic technology is no longer a significant impediment for producing transgenic beef cattle. I probably would add to that and say that we now also have a collection of technologies that allow us to do some very interesting and some much more complex types of manipulations. Now let me turn to the applications and first talk just a bit about agricultural applications. I went through the literature over the last 20 years, picked up all of the transgenic papers for large animals, and then went through and sorted those into those that were for cattle, and then tried to look at those that had specific agricultural applications. And when I came down to it, I found one paper that has been published that has a direct agricultural application, and it's for dairy cattle. It's not even for beef cattle. But basically, this is a group in New Zealand, and they inserted extra copies of the beta or kappa casein, and they actually did get significant increases in beta casein production and kappa casein production, which is something that's been of interest in the dairy industry for some time. Looking at other applications, the only other two papers that I saw were a couple that were directed towards the swine and could potentially have some application for beef cattle. But basically, one of those is out of the Beltsville USDA group. Another one is from Australia. And in both of these, they were really trying to genetically modify pigs to make them grow faster and leaner and more efficient. And in essence, they were successful with this. In this one, they inserted an insulin-like growth factor gene and reduced back fat and increased lean growth in gilts, not in boars. In this one, they inserted a growth hormone gene and increased live weight gain and feed efficiency and reduced back fat thickness. In fact, this one, if I remember correctly, the company that did this actually moved fairly far along in trying to commercialize this and eventually gave up on their effort, and it essentially has gone nowhere. So this is the status over the last 20 years of transgenic applications for animal agriculture. Not a lot. Now, why is that? And the question is, and I guess I could answer that in, for the last 20 years and say that in essence, technology was a major impediment for the last 20 years. And that's why the work was done in pigs as opposed to cattle. Very little work was done in cattle. And in fact, the dairy cattle paper was actually done with cloning technology in recent years. But primarily, it was a real technical limitation as to why nothing was done with transgenic applications for agriculture. However, I think going forward, now I don't see technology as being a major limitation. However, there are plenty of other limitations. First of all, is that if you do try to make a transgenic animal, you'd have to get it approved for human food consumption through the FDA. The way the FDA looks at these things is they look at three specific aspects. The first is food safety. Are the meat products from the animals or dairy or whatever, are they safe for human consumption? Now, obviously, you're not going to try to put something into the food chain if you think it's not going to be safe. In reality, for most of what we would do with transgenics, food safety is really not an issue. So food safety is something that I think would not be a big problem in trying to get through the FDA. Environmental impact, that's a big issue with transgenic crops and movement of genes into weed species and so forth. But for cows, you know, it gets out of the pen. It's not like it's going to go breed with wild species. So the environmental impact in that respect is probably very limited. On the other hand, I suspect the USDA or the FDA would look at it in regard to the transgene getting out into the population of cattle and what impact that might have on the total industry. So that is probably something that would have to be addressed. And then the other is animal welfare. And again, I don't think this is a real issue from the standpoint that we're not going to make an unhealthy transgenic animal and try to pawn it off on producers. It isn't going to work. You have to have an animal that's going to be very healthy, or else it's not going to compete and not going to be realizing its true growth potential. So these are the primary issues from the standpoint of the FDA. Now, whether the FDA is influenced by consumer issues, theoretically they're supposed to make decisions based on science. And science, in this regard, I think is pretty easy to handle. You can address those issues. But what the outcome of an FDA review would be, who knows? Now, from another issue would be the business model. A few years ago, I spent a lot of time looking into agricultural applications for various transgenic modifications, both in beef and dairy. And it's tough. It's a real challenge because the things that you have to deal with are, one, a lack of integration in the beef industry. I could come up with a lot of things that might help the retailer, such as extended shelf life, but I know that the cow-calf producer is not going to buy it unless the retailer is going to pay the processor for it, who's going to pay the feedlot for it, who's going to pay the stocker feeder for it, who's going to pay the cow-calf producer for it. Okay, so that's the kind of situation you get into, and it really became a great limitation. You know, we had things like one was putting an antioxidant gene into cattle to increase shelf life and beef, modifying milk production so that you get faster gel formation in yogurt, things like that. You know, you read the research articles, they look great. You know, works, no problem, easy to do. But you'll never sell it. Producer and consumer acceptance. There clearly is an issue, or going to be an issue, with a certain population of consumers that would never accept a genetically modified animal. Now, I would bet, but it's purely my opinion, that there's a very large percentage of the population that would say, if the FDA approves it, I could care less. As long as it's either giving me a better product or a cheaper product, or that I'm getting some benefit from this. So who knows how the consumer might react, and I think sometimes we're overly influenced by very, very small number of people or groups that claim to be consumer advocates, but are really representing only a small portion of the consumer population. And producer, of course, the producer is going to be very concerned about whether the consumer is going to accept it because you have to sell your product to somebody. And the next question is, how do you generate a profit from it? There are some genetic factors to be concerned with. For example, zygosity, if you're trying to sell a transgenic. Do you have to sell this in a way where you have homozygous males and females to pass on the trait? Or can you simply pass on the trait as a single copy in the heterozygous state? Of course, if you do that and only your bull is heterozygous, then half your offspring are not going to have the gene. So it gets to be somewhat complicated in how you do that. And the other thing is, as I mentioned previously, the insert site. I think this is very important. Because if you're going to make a line of animals for agriculture, you need to be able to come back and add new genetics to that pool, to that population. The only way you're going to do that is if you can target a specific insert site, and also that allows you to generate homozygotes much more quickly. So those are some of the issues in regards to putting transgenics into agriculture. Now, conclusion from this, I still believe that there is great long-term potential but currently there are significant impediments for market entry. So one of the ways that you look at this is you could say that, well, I'm going to take my risk and I'm going to assume that by the time I get this transgenic product ready to go in the market, the consumer interest or consumer concerns will have changed, and I can pick a type of product that would have higher consumer acceptability. So I guess my view is that there still is a lot of potential for transgenics. The time may not be right now. On the other hand, it's never too early to start thinking about these things and maybe start testing some things. Okay, the next thing is human medicine. I went through the literature and I got the publications for all of the studies in which a human therapeutic protein had been produced in, I believe it was in cattle, actually. Although some of these may be sheep in here too, but I think it's primarily cattle. And basically what you have is human alpha lactalbumin produced in milk. As Dr. Faber talked about, their human serum albumin project. There's been a human lactoferrin project and a human bile salt stimulated lipase project. These are all human therapeutic proteins produced in the milk of transgenic animals, using the animal as a production system for large volume, low cost production. Now, what I'd like to do is to turn to something a little closer to home, a little more to my interest, and this is what we're doing at Hemotech, and it's a little different than what has been done with the milk expression systems. It's a definitely a more complex system, but I think it has tremendous application. At Hemotech, what we're doing is making cows that will produce human instead of cow antibodies. These are polyclonal antibodies, not monoclonal. So the idea here is that once we got this genetic line of cows, we can take a vaccine, in fact, any vaccine off the shelf, or we can develop vaccines, immunize the cow, come in a few months later, collect plasma from the cow, then separate off the antibodies from the serum component, and out comes a whole array of different types of products, human therapeutic products. The idea here is that antibodies have tremendously broad applications because of their characteristics, and so there are lots of things we can do with those. The idea here is that we have one genetic line of cow so that we can do a lot of complex manipulations, and we don't have to do them for every new product. We can use this cow for many different products. Now, just a bit about antibodies. Basically, what are antibodies? If you go in for a blood donation, they collect blood, you let it set for a while, it'll clot, and then there's this kind of yellowish serum component that comes off the top. Within the fluid part of blood, there are lots of different antibodies that are floating around, and they look something like this. They have two arms that reach out with hands and grab on pathogens as they're floating around. And those hands are important because they can recognize specific sites and tell what shouldn't be there from what should be. So it's those two hands that are really important. So antibodies can be used, and in fact have been used, to treat a wide variety of different infections. They can be used to get rid of cancer cells. They can be used in organ transplant rejection to get rid of the immune cells that are involved in rejection. And also, interestingly, they've been used in autoimmune diseases. So lots of different applications here. Well, how do you make a cow to make human antibodies? Well, there are two steps to it. The first step is you put in the human antibody genes, and the second is you inactivate or get rid of the cow antibody genes. Okay? So in concept, it's fairly straightforward. However, the human antibody genes are extraordinarily large and very complex. Each of the genes, you need two of them, each of them are well over a million base pairs. And the only way you can really do this is using a microchromosome technology. The inactivation, well, there are multiple genes that need to be inactivated, and there are two alleles for each gene, one on the male-derived chromosomes, one on the female-derived chromosomes. So you really have to have a gene-targeting technology. So what we've been doing at Hemotech for the last, I guess now about 5 years, is we've been developing this microchromosome technology and the gene targeting technologies for this application for making cows to produce human antibodies. So I'm not going to go through the details on this because it gets pretty complex. I think the important underlying points are here, though, and that is that we're now beyond an era of transgenics and just manipulating single genes. We're now in an era where we're actually doing chromosome engineering. Now, we're not doing this ourselves. We're working with some collaborators from Japan, from the Kirin company, that actually have developed this microchromosome technology. And it's just really fabulous stuff. But what they've done is they've taken a piece of chromosome 14. They generated a fragment of chromosome 14 that they found was stable and could be passed on from cell to cell and generation to generation. And that piece of chromosome 14 contains one of the antibody genes. They then found, they tried to get stable pieces that contained the other antibody genes, couldn't do it. So they came up with this novel approach of actually clipping out the piece from another chromosome and inserting it into this stable chromosome to make effectively a microchromosome that's derived from two different human chromosomes. And this is a fantastic picture here because this is the microchromosome. The red, I've got this color-coded, the red is the chromosome 14 fragment, and the green on the other end is the chromosome 22 fragment. The white area in the middle is the centromere, and then, of course, the yellow here are the two telomeres, which make up the ends of the chromosome. And this little microchromosome here contains all of those elements and functions just along, you know, just as a baby chromosome and goes along for the ride. So it doesn't integrate into any of the other chromosomes. It's a completely separate, independent chromosome. So it's a nice system for making genetic modifications. You don't have to disturb the animal's own DNA to be able to make the genetic modification. You can actually just manipulate this little kind of satellite chromosome. Now, we've been able to do this in cows, and actually, if you go out to the facility, I don't know whether it'll be on the tour or not, but we have quite a number of calves out at the Transova facility that carry a human microchromosome. And this is a set of those calves, and you can see here the little red dot. These are the cow chromosomes here, and this little red dot is the human microchromosome that carries both of these long antibody genes. And we found that these calves do produce a low level of human antibody. The genes seem to work fine in the cow, from everything that we can tell. The problem is that they're competing with cow antibodies, so we've got to get rid of the cow antibodies. And this is a picture. In fact, this is very new stuff. The publication for this is supposed to be come out online on, I think, on Monday. So this stuff is actually not technically published yet. But we've been able to knock out genes in cows. And in fact, this set of calves, we knocked out one of the alleles of a gene. And then this, which is a younger but genetically identical to this, except that this has two alleles. In other words, it's a homozygous knockout. And we found that we can go ahead and we've got a system where we can do sequential gene knockouts, so we can go, in fact, we're up to about five or six in the same cell lines. So you can do some very complicated genetic modifications using these technologies. Now, one of the things that I thought I would show you is that, first of all, as beef producers, you're probably not going to get into the business of making pharmaceutical proteins in milk or human I hope you're not going to get into human antibodies in cows. We don't need any competitors. So where do you fit in this whole industry of human therapeutics? Is there a place for a beef producer to fit? Well, let me go through the system that we have, or the system that we've designed for producing these animals. And maybe there are places where the producer can fit into this. But basically, we start with the recipients. Recipients need to be obtained from known sources, preferably closed herds produced under strict disease control and monitoring standards. So you have your source herds for recipient cows. These then go into a quarantine center and are tested very extensively to make sure that they don't carry certain diseases of interest. And this gives you a disease break into your system. You then go to an embryo transfer center that has a recipient pool. And in that pool, and this is exactly what you'll see out of Transova, because they're the ones that are doing this for us at this point, but they have an embryo transfer center with a recipient pool. Dave said something around 3,000 to 4,000 animals. The embryos that we produce in the lab here in Sioux Falls then are transported out to the recipient pool. They're put in. We'll do about this year probably 80,000 manipulations, which should result in about 10 or 12,000 embryos. So it's a large process of being able to do this. So we do, and we'll probably use about 2,500 recipients this year for this project. So the pregnant recipients then are maintained to 245 days. They then go to a calving center. And at the calving center, the recipients are separated from the calves, and there is a disease break here. This time, we take all the calves by cesarean, and they're taken across the hall into a clean area. Then there would be another disease break from when the calves would go into the production center, where they would be immunized. You'd collect blood or plasma from those animals, and then take it to a purification center. So the conclusion on this is, I think there is, first of all, there's potential, and in fact, we've been hiring people, but there's potential for salaried positions in the cattle industry. In other words, for those of you that have been in the cattle industry and you have your animals and so forth, you're not looking for a job. On the other hand, your kids may have gone through school and are looking to be in the cattle industry, but there's really not a place for them to go. So we look at this as a place for kids that have some training but want to stay in the industry and would like to have a salaried position as opposed to necessarily being based on the outcome of their animals. And also for production of qualified recipients and for feed production. We're in the process of now trying to put together plans for the future in which we will have our recipient herd sourced and have our embryo transfer production system, have our feed supplies and so forth. And we have to be very careful about food supplies for these animals also. So those are areas I think that for the future, if this is successful and it expands with many different therapeutics, we definitely will be interfacing with the agricultural industry and will be requiring input from that industry. And I think that is the last slide that I have. Yeah. So thank you for your attention, and would be happy to answer any questions, I guess either now or later. Thank you.